The forecast from the National Weather Service today, cloudy and seasonal, high of 63. Now 54 degrees Racine, 63 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. As many WGTD morning show listeners know, in my other life, I am a musician. In fact, an associate professor of music at nearby Carthage College. So whenever I am able to talk about music within the context of this program, it's always an exciting day. And especially when I can talk with the author of a book which is as thorough and fascinating and comprehensive as the book before us today called Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. The author of the book, Nolan Gasser, is himself a professional musician in a number of different ways. But perhaps most pertinent to the creation of this book, he is also largely responsible for one of the hallmarks of Pandora Radio and Pandora Radio's Music Genome Project, and was their chief musicologist right from the founding of Pandora back in 2000. We'll talk, for the sake of any of you who are not acquainted with Pandora, about what it is and about the remarkable things that it achieves for those who listen to it. And it is an incredible feat that he has created there, and in the creation of this book, in which he seeks to explore what is behind, first of all, in general, human beings and their attraction to music, and why it is that certain people are attracted to certain kinds of music or certain aspects of music. And having some understanding of that has been key to what he has done with Pandora. And, of course, that is the heart and soul of this book. Again, titled Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste, published by Flatiron Books. And Nolan Gasser, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg.
Looking forward to this. It's an amazing book and an amazing undertaking. I wonder, when you began writing this book, did you have a sense that you were ultimately going to be writing a book that would be 700 pages long and such an arduous undertaking?
You know, I think had I known it was going to be such an arduous 700-page journey, I might not have started. But that's often the case in life. You begin something because you have a passion for it and sort of a vision for what it could be, and then it takes a life of its own. And this book definitely sort of required me in many ways to explore terrain that I might not have imagined when I first set out on this journey.
Say a quick word, if you would, about your own personal background as a musician before we get to the story of Pandora.
Sure. Well, indeed, as you mentioned, I've been a practicing musician really my entire life. I began playing piano at the age of 4, so I'm told. and began, you know, sort of writing my own music, you know, certainly by the time I was, you know, 10 or 11. In fact, my very first gig, I was 11 years old, and I was fortunate enough to get a job playing in the local shopping center in the food court every Saturday and Sunday afternoon for a couple hours. And that really was an incredibly impactful experience for me as a young musician. Of course, it helped me to build up a, you know, pretty good repertoire. It, you know, helped my ear to develop. But it also, I think, was a good thing for my sort of natural inclination to be pretty eclectic, because I'd have people come up and say, can you play Scott Joplin? Can you play Mozart? Can you play Rodgers and Hammerstein? Can you play Stairway to Heaven, which was a perennial? And that, you know, of course, it just helped me to, you know, play a wide variety of styles. But I think it was an early clue to me how interesting it is that we all have different tastes in music. I certainly didn't think about it in those terms in those early years, but it was good seeds to lay. And then I just continued on my path. I ended up pursuing an undergraduate out in California, where I'm from, in piano and composition. And then after my undergraduate, I spent 2 years in Paris, and that really was perhaps the most sort of seminal, you know, sort of decision, in at least sort of in terms of this book. I studied with a composer and did all of that and played jazz in a jazz club. But it was when I was in Paris that I happened upon a CD. This was the late 80s, of the music of a Renaissance composer named Josquin des Prez. Who's not terribly well known to many of your listeners, I imagine, but really an absolute titan of the era, the same age as Leonardo da Vinci, and every bit as monumental in his craft and his expression. And it just kind of blew me away. It has, as you may know, it has kind of a praxis and an orientation towards the sort of musical elements that is quite different from our own day, even quite different from the music of Bach. And it just sort of blew my mind, and I kind of needed to understand what made it tick. And that led me eventually to a path to pursue a PhD in Renaissance musicology at Stanford. And it was at the end of that journey, just prior to finishing up my thesis, that I got an email, and this is in early 2000, from a fellow named Tim Westergren, who just a couple of months earlier had gotten some seed money for a music technology company. It was called Savage Beast Technologies back then, typical of the age. And I was fortunate enough to become the head of the music operation. And, of course, a few years later, that became Pandora.
I want you to explain something which I think is so important in understanding the Pandora story, namely something you mention as one of the topics of that first conversation you had with Tim Westergren. You say that among the things you talked about was the current chaos in the music industry. Describe to our listeners what kind of chaos you are talking about and how that chaos, in a sense, folds into the story of why and how Pandora was born.
Sure. Well, part of the chaos was in just this sort of wild frontier of digital music, which was just in its infancy. 1999 and early 2000 was the age of Napster. And if you recall, this is way before iTunes, before the iPhone, before you could actually purchase digital music. And so Napster was this file sharing format that people could, you know, share music, but it was sort of stealing it. And so you had this kind of crazy world there and all the lawsuits. But then even in the you know, CD and album world, of course, albums were not really happening. It was CDs. They were under such tight control, you know, by the record labels and, you know, even by the DJs, of really limiting what people could get exposure to. There was just that front rack of a Tower Records that had its, you know, seven or eight albums. And so you had this sort of limited amount of music that was in the commercial realm and this wild, you know, anything goes in the early digital world. So chaos might be a little strong, but certainly we felt that there was an opportunity. This was certainly Tim and Will Glazer, another one of the founders' vision, that by marrying intense music analysis with sort of database algorithms, there was a way of being smart about how you recommend and how you introduce music fans to possible favorites. By not necessarily basing it on who sold the most records or who's the most popular, but what's actually going on under the hood of the music. And that's the birth of the Music Genome Project, and I was fortunate enough to be able to be given the task of being the architect of it. And that started in 2000, and we never would have guessed that it would have the impact that it did, but I think we were really fortunately at the right place at the right time, maybe a little too ahead of the curve for the music industry because those early years were pretty rough, but certainly a great blessing for me.
Absolutely. I like how at one point you call this the launch of a tech company to tackle arcane problems like music fan matchmaking. Which is kind of an interesting right. way to look at the mission of Pandora.
Yeah, well, I mean, really, and I think this is an important thing, you know, for those who kind of have some sense of what Pandora is and what it may represent. That first conversation and really the whole, you know, birth of the company was built on kind of a moral foundation. And that was certainly imperative to Tim, as it was to me, that we really do a good service for those working musicians out there, those bands and artists that weren't getting a fair crack. Also to the fans that, you know, were kind of forced to go through the, you know, the dusty bins of the used record store to find music. You know, how could we really help both sides of the equation to find each other? And to help, as we like to say, sort of build a sort of musician's middle class. And, you know, that certainly continues to be part of the mission of the company. But that really was. It was a bit of matchmaking because many people, you know, don't have the luxury of, you know, maybe having access to a real expert at a record store or someone who has an encyclopedic knowledge of music. And so to help that in that dynamic was important to us.
We're speaking with Nolan Gasser, and we're talking about his book, Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. So you were brought aboard Pandora as its musicologist to develop this thing that came to be known as the Music Genome Project. First of all, explain that intriguing name and explain the heart and soul of the work that you did in the early going.
Sure. Well, the name itself was actually coined by Will Glazer, who really an interesting character, and I try to, you know, give him his due in the first chapter of the book, kind of a sort of a story within a story. But Will is the son of a Nobel laureate in neurobiology or in molecular biology, excuse me. So he has obviously a very strong science background. And the 1990s and early, you know, early 2000s was the age of the Human Genome Project, when scientists aimed to define the entire you know, sort of gene content of the human species. And so it was in the air, and it was, I think, a little bit of a light sort of joke to call it the Music Genome Project. But I really took it seriously, and I think it helped me to define what this enterprise could be. And I sort of began to liken each big genre of music to a species, that if we could define the genotype, if you will, of the rock species, as opposed to the jazz species, as opposed to the classical or world music species, obviously a bit artificial, but that way we could sort of define the entire set of factors, the entire set of genes, if you will, across all of the musical parameters of melody, harmony, rhythm, form, sound, production, lyrics, that really seems to you know, be present in the entire panoply of possibilities in that musical realm. Then we could analyze every song or every work within that species according to this same set of genes, the same set of factors. And that was the best way that we could really sort of relate one song, even if very, very, very distant. So a song by Buddy Holly compared to a song by Pink Floyd, compared to a song by the Sex Pistols, they're very different. But if they're all on the same, you know, set of factors, we have a really good way of understanding their relationship in a kind of global way, much like we are sort of closely related to members of our own family, but maybe related in less sort of global way, more specific ways to other people. So too can songs. And so each genome, there are seven genomes. Each genome has hundreds of genes. Not the 20,000 that make up the actual human genome, but still enough individual factors that we can make some pretty sophisticated connections. Mm. So that's a little sense of it.
Absolutely. And one of the things that's so interesting as you describe kind of the creation of this is how it began, in a sense, quite simply. That is, not so much that you had a simpler idea, but some of your colleagues had a simpler idea of what such a framework might look like, just in sort of kind of the sheer number of possibilities of various categories and so on. And it's just interesting to read of as you kind of describe the kind of exponential explosion in terms of the complexity of all this in order to really do it right. Can you explain to our listeners what I'm talking about?
Yeah, sure. Well, that, you know, Tim Westergren himself is a musician. He played in several rock bands and did some film composing. So he certainly, you know, had awareness of music. He didn't have sort of an advanced degree. He had never studied in a real formal sense. So his first pass at this, I think, had, you know, maybe 40 genes in the rock, pop rock category. And so it was pretty very high level. And a lot of those genes were just names of instruments. So, you know, being, you know, sort of steeped in the arcana of music theory and having analyzed, obviously, a lot of very sophisticated music, I saw that even pop music needed to be as, you know, as rigorous as the music demanded. So, you know, how do you go about actually quantifying how melodies in the pop rock world are manifest? How do you talk about harmony and rhythm and meter and syncopation in ways that you can actually quantify them, not just yes or no, but if so, if an instrument is present or if a particular, you know, type of melodic contour, in other words, the shape of the melody is present, how do you kind of quantify it? How much does it impact not just the sort of objective nature of the music itself, but importantly, our experience of it? So in other words, my first early passes, even in the pop realm, kind of blew up the first pass from, you know, 40 or 50 genes to close to 300. Mm. You know, that obviously allowed us to dive into the nuances. And maybe I should just mention, too, that a lot of people are actually surprised to learn, even if they've been using Pandora for years, that every song that you hear, every song in the database, millions of songs now, has been analyzed by an actual human being who sits in front of a computer with that, you know, genome in front of them. So if they're doing, you know, a Miles Davis song track or a new piece by a classical composer, they need to be trained in that musical style, versed in it, and then they will go through all of those genes and code them, if you will. So that's what gives Pandora its intelligence and its power.
Hmm. It's also interesting to read of one struggle of sorts that occurred relatively late in the process of constructing this world music genome. And that is when it came to what was probably the least significant, commercially speaking, of any of these sectors of music, namely classical, the one that means the most to me, and maybe on some level at least means the most to you. And there, you had to really, in a sense, draw a line in the sand and stand your ground when it came to the way in which the classical sector was going to be handled. Can you just say a quick word about that? I think it's an interesting
moment. Absolutely. Well, I certainly appreciate that. Yeah, it's certainly not a big story in the history of the company, but it was a big story to me.
Right.
You know, the classical genome is the last genome, almost sort of typical. As you say, indeed, I am sort of a classical musician at heart, even though I was raised on rock and roll and play jazz and all that. But, you know, that is sort of the grand poobah of musical realms in terms of the breadth of its history and the level of sophistication possible. And so, of course, when I got word that we were going to start a classical genome, I was just beyond thrilled. But there had been changes in the company. This was no longer Savage Beast. This was now Pandora. And so we were now out of, you know, this sort of thriving, sort of burgeoning commercial enterprise. And so we wanted to get classical out there. But the initial impetus was to not do the deep dive and go through the full rigorous process of sort of vetting the genre through all kinds of workshops and really, you know, going through everything from Gregorian chant to the latest piece by Ligeti or whatever. Instead, what the company proposed is that we kind of fall back on sort of genre labels, and that maybe, you know, use other kinds of what is called metadata, sort of commonly available easy tags that don't dive into the music itself, and so that the classical genome would maybe have 30 individual genes, 30 factors that could be quickly done. And, you know, so you could probably imagine I was just aghast. They would, you know, rather than, you know, be the most sophisticated with the sort of the richest in terms of history realm, but be the least sophisticated. And so I fought and made every argument that you couldn't possibly tell one Beethoven string quartet movement from another, and you really couldn't do justice to the music, and you'd have a lot of bad matches. I was lucky that I managed to convince them. So they said, all right, go ahead and do your normal process. And it was definitely sort of a whew moment. And indeed, the classical genome is the largest and most in-depth. And there are some interesting distinctions between the classical genome and other genomes. And I can just very, very quickly just mention, for those of you listeners that are classical fans might find this interesting, that whereas in the rock realm or in the jazz realm, certainly, if I take a particular song, so someday my prince will come, that's been done by, you know, by dozens of jazz artists, or, you know, take a sort of a Bob Dylan song that's been done by myriad artists. Each one of those versions will be analyzed as a unique sort of entry, because the interpreter will take his or her distinct path on it, and so it needs to be analyzed as a distinct unit. But a classical piece, so if I take a symphony by Sibelius, whether it's done by the San Francisco Symphony or the Chicago Symphony, the notes are the same. So generally speaking, we only analyze the classical works once. And those really fine distinctions between one performance and another, we sort of leave to the critics, and as opposed to analyzing each one as a distinct unit.
Right. The thought of trying to do that is kind of mind-boggling, and this is all mind-boggling enough, actually. You write, as you're talking about the construction of this, the classical genome contains over 350 genes, and it is indeed the genome of which I am most proud, perhaps admittedly because it was the last. With over 1,500 years of music creation spread across dozens of countries around the world, principally in Europe, of course, the classical repertoire is a massively rich and varied triumph of human inventiveness. And I am thus so grateful that I was able to tackle it on a genomic level for the benefit of Pandora listeners. And before we leave Pandora to talk more specifically about some things in your book, I think we have not yet probably taken the moment we should to explain to any listeners who don't know what Pandora is, what it is, what one experiences if you have Pandora. I know very well because my wife has been a very, very big fan of Pandora for a long, long time and made extensive use of it. But for someone who does not use Pandora or have any direct experience with it, how would you best explain how the typical listener experiences Pandora?
Sure. Well, Pandora is personalized internet radio. At least that's the main service that we provide, and it's of course now available on any device, on your home computer, on your phone, on your iPad or Kindle. And you just create an account, very simple, and you begin to create your own individual set of radio stations. And all you do is you start with a seed. You pick an artist, you pick a song, you pick a composer in the classical world, and so you can create a Vivaldi station. And so it will begin playing works by Vivaldi. And we'll play one work, and then it will play something by Bach or something by Telemann. And as the different works, or if you create a song based on Taylor Swift or whatever it is, it will begin playing songs. And you then, as a listener, can say, I like this, thumbs up, or I don't like this, thumbs down. So you don't need to go in and say that you don't like that particular kind of harmony or anything of that nature. You just say, I like it, thumbs up. I don't like it, thumbs down. And by doing that over a period of time, over maybe a good sort of dozen selections, you begin to train that station so that your Vivaldi station or your Taylor Swift station or your Proud Mary station or whatever it might be is different from anybody else's, because it will be based on your particular preferences. And the algorithm then tries to say, okay, well, this got a thumbs up, so there's whatever's going on in this track, this things that we should try to emulate those. And then as you say thumbs down, especially over several thumbs down, the algorithm tries to figure out what are the sets of genes that might be in common to all those thumbs down tracks, and let's try to avoid those and try to increase the recommendations that have those positive attributes. So you, again, as we like to say, you start to train your station so that it plays tracks that you like. And you can create, as many as 100 stations, and you can add more than one seed to a station. So it really becomes your own, exploration in music. And I would say that now, as opposed to even about a year ago, Pandora does what Spotify and Apple Music and others do as well, is it not only creates radio, but it allows you to select music on demand. In other words, you can say, I want to hear this particular track from this particular album 3 times in a row. That's a service called Pandora Premium, so it's a little bit more money than just the sort of normal radio version. But you can go seamlessly back and forth. You can be on the radio and you can hear a track or by an artist that you've never heard before, and then you can click on that artist and hear an entire album, or you can be listening to an album and you can create a radio station based on one of the tracks. So hopefully that gives a sense of what Pandora is.
Will wonders never cease? Do you have time for a couple of more questions?
Of course, indeed. And I should just mention, the history of Pandora is but one small chapter in this book.
Absolutely. That's why I want to make sure people understand all that is here. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Nolan Gasser, who, as we have been talking just now, is the architect of Pandora Radio's Music Genome Project and its chief musicologist upon the company's founding back in 2000. But more to the point today, the author of a really interesting book called Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste, which explores the whole realm of music in all of its different forms, the various building blocks by which music is constructed, and examined also through a long historical lens as well. A thoroughly fascinating book from start to finish. Early in the book, in the introduction, you bring up the matter of musical taste, which of course is part of the title of the book. And I think you are very wise to sort of call into question how we use that term, and especially when we start talking about somebody having good taste or bad taste or no taste. How do you want us to think about that within the context of your book?
Right. Well, you know, part of it is sort of inspired by something that I hear a lot from people, that they're almost sort of apologetic when I'm doing a concert or talking to people. They'll say, oh, I know nothing about music. So there's this, if they're not trained in music or they don't play in music, a lot of people almost are sort of deferential in their own musicality. And part of that comes out of this sort of, you know, sort of spirit that there is this notion of good taste as opposed to bad taste. And in order to have good taste, you need to, you know, be somewhat trained or schooled. This is actually an idea that has, you know, roots going back to the ancient Greeks, and then especially in the 17th century with philosophers like David Hume, you know, that if you really want to, you know, understand the best examples of art, it needs to be, you know, shared with you or sort of given to you by someone with great experience and skills, as opposed to, you know, just your average person. And really, I think that in our day and age, that's starting to just be exposed as a fallacy. But I really want to bring that to the fore, that there really is no such thing as good taste or bad taste. As I say, it's only good taste if something is only good if it's good to you. We can talk about distinctions in sort of technique or sort of scope or breadth. We can certainly say that, you know, the St. Matthew Passion of Bach is a more complex, more sophisticated piece of music than a song by Taylor Swift. But it's not to say that one is better than the other. That really, at the end of the day, comes down to how you interpret it. And if you have 100 people and 95 of them think that the St. Matthew Passion is a greater piece of music than the Taylor Swift song, all it means is that there's consensus. It doesn't mean that it's true in any sense, in any objective sense. So part of it is just to get people to realize that, you know, they can own and feel proud about their own perspective on what is good music. And so they can figure out what makes their good music tick, and explore and, you know, go ahead and enhance that and expand that by learning more about themselves and about what's out there. Mm.
The essential framework of the book is around various building blocks of music, like melody and harmony and rhythm and form and sheer sound, which I want to be sure we have time to talk about. But then there are also a number of different interludes in which you take us off on things that I would scarcely call tangents, because they're in many cases very near to the heart and soul of what this book is all about. And I want to be sure that we take a moment to talk about interlude A, in which you kind of raise one of the most fascinating of questions, namely whether or not all human beings love music, and if so, why? And there really aren't too many things that all people or nearly all people love the way just about all people seem to love music in one way or another, I mean, in some sort of form. What prompted you to sort of explore this really complicated question?
Well, I think that, you know, as I thought about how to tackle this subject of what is musical taste and where does it come from and what does it say about us and how can it make our lives richer, I think, as we talked about initially, I had probably a more narrow approach to that. But as I began doing my own research and my own thinking about it, you know, you do recognize that music is one of those few things that is so universally loved and has such, you know, direct links to so many aspects of our lives and our identity and even beyond those more tangible things, but even the sort of the very nature of in physics, the very nature of sound and all that. So it all plays, as I began to recognize and I wanted to articulate, it all plays a role in defining our musical taste. So yes, indeed, it is. As you mentioned, the book is sort of divided between a set of sort of purely musical chapters. The first is a set of unveilings of the different main parameters of music, melody, harmony, and the like. And then I go into deeper dives into those different species of music to try to get a sense of, what's going on in their realms. Be basically kind of an excuse to dive under the hood of music. But interweaving into those musical discussions are these interludes, which I kind of liken it to a mystery novel. That it begins at the sort of 10,000-foot view of saying, why is it that we all love music and certain approaches to music? And so that begins with our very evolution, that indeed music, there's no culture on earth that does not have music as a kind of a sacred part of its own identity, that music accompanies those vital traditions, religious traditions, rites of passage, in terms of love and marriage and romance. So music is just one of those things that is just ubiquitous in our lives. And of course that raises question, okay, well, so if music is so ubiquitous, there are, I guess, two important questions. Where did it come from? When did we start making music? And the second question is, okay, so if music is so much a part of every culture and part of being human, did music actually help us to evolve? Is music an adaptive trait, maybe like language or other things that makes us human, that allowed us to evolve, out of the apes and out of the Neanderthals? And so without trying to explore that here, that's obviously something that takes a lot of pages to unfold, both of those questions. But the bottom line is that, the evidence is out there. We have been making music since really our earliest days as a species. I make a sort of posit the notion that our general musicality and our ability to be creative with sound and all that it gives us as a species, as individuals and collectively, may have been one of those key factors that helped us to eventually get out of our cradle in Africa's small little community and to go out and conquer the world. Because our successful conquering of the planet about 70,000 years ago was actually our second attempt. Our first attempt failed. And so it's the question, why did our second attempt work? And I won't say that it's because they had sort of better instruments and better songs, but I do think our ability to be musical is and be creative and to tell stories the way that music can, as opposed to purely language can, may have been a critical factor. And again, there's a big debate about whether music was adaptive or not. I call it the big cheesecake debate. So you'll have to read the book to understand why that's the case. But it's amazing how scholars can get so passionate about two sides of a pretty arcane question.
But it is a fascinating question for sure. In the chapter devoted to melody, which you call the face of music, I love that terminology, you mention the fact that your book focuses very little on lyrics. Whether we're talking about lyrics of a pop song or the libretto of an opera or whatever, you Right. don't spend much time on lyrics. And it was interesting when I read that, I realized that in the times when I have taught, for instance, exploring music, which is kind of our introductory course where I teach a course for non-music majors, that this can sometimes be a real issue for someone not trained in music the way that you and I are, to untangle the words from a song and, in a sense, set them aside so you're listening just to the melody, or just to the rhythm, or just to the pulse, but for I should newcomers or amateurs or whatever you want to say, it's can be very, very difficult to do that. To them, it's all of a piece that cannot be separated. And I thought that was an interesting point you made.
Well, certainly, and this is by no means to sort of disparage or to, you know, say this to cast as sort of secondary in our experience or why we may like something or not like something, to sort of, you know, say that lyrics are not important. They certainly are. And we used to say at Pandora that, you know, the world is in some ways divided between music people and lyrics people, people that, you know, that really focus on the lyrics primarily. Oh, yeah, and there's melody, but it's really the lyrics that grab me, as opposed to people that really could kind of care less what the song is saying. It's, you know, it's all those other musical factors. Of course, most of us are somewhere in between. You know, it's really... In terms of trying to get a sense of our musical taste and what's going on, you know, lyrics obviously are important, but how I try to frame it is that, you know, in most cases, you know, the composer, the artist is trying to, sort of reflect the sentiment, the meaning, the actual syllables and the accents, this sort of scansion of the lyrics in a sort of proper way. So if we sort of assume that in many cases the music properly sort of reflects the sort of setting of the lyrics, then we're out of the realm of sort of talking about music, and now we're talking about poetics. We're talking about, you know, text and meaning and rhetoric and all that. And if I tried to tackle that in this book, it would have been 1,400 pages. So I certainly didn't want to do that. I do end up kind of going almost a little bit back on myself in a couple of instances. There are a few techniques that are really purely in the musical realm that do get at what composers are thinking about when they set text. There's different ways in which a melody can be, you know, one syllable per note, syllabic, or in different styles, and not just in classical, but in pop and jazz as well, where there will be a single syllable which is held for many, many notes, kind of as a melisma, as it's technically called. And that generally will have some reflection, again, of the poetry of the music, or of the lyrics, rather, what it's saying, but perhaps not. And so that's, again, it is sort of a lyric issue, but sort of a musical, one first. And another key way of that relationship is when composers, and this is a little bit more in the classical realm, at least in sort of easily identified examples of sort of what is called word painting, when a composer will, set a lyric about climbing a mountain by having a scale going up, or something that's kind of reflecting, how sound can, which is kind of a really powerful thing to think about, that just pure sound and pitch can reflect, thoughts that are really tangible in that way. So, and then also when I talk about hip hop and rap music, you can't but, get at talking about the lyrics. But, that's really sort of a secondary topic.
Right. We should also say that when you then explore these various genotypes, that you remind us again and again that we listen to music for various reasons. And that, for instance, if one just takes oneself through a typical day, there's something that might be right for the drive to work, and something else for the drive back home, and something for when you're relaxing, and something for when you're about to go to bed, and versus when you're lifting weights or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. I mean, music serves many functions, and it's important to remember that, or else one is going to approach all of this a little too simplistically.
Right. Well, that's an absolutely, it's certainly a very seminal point, and really something that in time even services like Pandora can learn from, is that our musical taste is obviously a very complex thing. It's a reflection of many things. As I talked about that mystery novel, we can think about all those things that bind us together as humans, and as we dive deeper, all of us raised in the West, will be exposed to certain kinds of scales, certain kinds of meters and rhythms, certain kinds of harmonies and instruments that sound normal. And then our musical taste gets fine-tuned by the sort of subcultures, or I call them intracultures. And of course, these are all the sort of different interludes in the book, diving into that, you know, heading towards what makes our individual taste happen. Through the subcultures that we, you know, the cliques and communities that we reside in, we get exposed to music. And then the final interlude is our individual psychology. And that's really how does our personality, our approach towards interpreting emotion, our exposure to things, how does that impact our individual musical taste? But even when we get at that, we have to recognize that, you know, our musical taste is a many splendored thing, and things that would be absolutely, you know, wonderful, and, you know, that we would, you know, embrace as something that we would, you know, claim as fitting our sort of hit parade for a dinner party might be something that we would never want to listen to, you know, as we're studying, and vice versa. So as we get to understand our individual musical taste, just to be aware that there are even different approaches towards melody and harmony and rhythm that will, you know, fit our taste in one context, say studying or working out at the gym or socializing with friends, that would not work in another. So that we, you know, we kind of recognize as we can what's going on musically, what's going on expression-wise, emotionally, but also those musical elements in these different contexts, because those are not only reflections of our musical taste, but in some ways reflections of our personality. So that is absolutely true. So I kind of get started with that notion when I explore these individual genotypes and break up a sort of day in the life, if you're a jazz fan or if you're a world music fan.
Mm. And in the epilogue of the book, you I think tie things up so nicely to say that by just understanding a little more clearly what we like and why we like it, it is in effect empowering our musical taste and maybe allowing that music to affect us even more powerfully and to derive even deeper and more lasting satisfaction from it. Certainly that is what I take away from your book, among many other valuable and insightful lessons. The book again is called Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. It's published by Flatiron Books. It is an expansive book, comprehensive, thorough, meticulously researched, and beautifully written by my morning show guest, Nolan Gasser. Nolan Gasser, I congratulate you on a stunning bit of writing, on a monumental undertaking done so very, very well. And I thank you for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it.
Thank you so much, Greg. I certainly appreciate it.
Tomorrow on the morning show, my latest conversation with historian and novelist Ralph Peters. His books are mostly rooted in the American Civil War, and his latest book is titled Darkness at Chancellorsville, a novel of Stonewall Jackson's triumph and tragedy. A very, very interesting book indeed. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. And if you like, you can also hear the program via podcast. You can subscribe via Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or Spotify. And when you subscribe to The Morning Show with Greg Bird, you hear a different morning show 7 days a week. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admission/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake